but they were a distinguished panel all the same. Denise Myerson came to Australia from the University of Cape Town, where she's still an honorary professor of law. But for some years now, she's been a professor in the Division of Law at Macquarie University. She's been a visiting fellow at All Souls College in Oxford. She's written very extensively on jurisprudence, on public law, comparative constitutionalism, theoretical foundations of all that, human rights law, law and religion, and so on. Her most recent book, which I haven't even seen yet, is called Understanding Jurisprudence, published in 2007. And her topic today is Chapter 3 and Control Orders and that aspect of Thomas and Mowbray.
Thank you, Tony. The Chapter 3 question in Thomas was whether federal courts can be enlisted in the government's anticipatory response to terrorism. Are the powers which Division 104 confers on federal courts non-judicial or required to be exercised non-judicially? A majority of the High Court answered no. Chief Justice Gleeson, Justices Gummow, Crennan, Cullinan and Hayden. Justices Kirby and Hayne dissented. Justice Kirby on both counts, Justice Hayne confining himself to the former issue. What is judicial power? The paradigm case of judicial power involves the authoritative determination of disputes about existing legal rights according to determinate legal standards on the basis of past events or conduct. But this is not the only judicial function. The chameleon doctrine allows governmental powers, which are not distinctively legislative, executive, or judicial, to be assigned to any of the governmental branches. Furthermore, judicial power is an amorphous notion, according to the High Court, and there is no single formulation by which it can be captured. Hence, judicial power is not as strictly quarantined from non-judicial power as boilermakers might have seemed to suggest. However, even the chameleon doctrine has its limits. A power which is foreign to the judicial function cannot be converted into judicial power by reposing it in the judiciary. Conversely, a core judicial function cannot be turned into a non-judicial function by reposing it in the political branches. If these limits to the chameleon doctrine did not exist, the legislature would be at large to bypass the separation of powers. Justices Kirby and Hayne expressly made this point in Thomas, and the other judges implicitly accepted it by asking whether the powers conferred by Division 104 are susceptible of judicial exercise. Boilermakers has therefore not passed its use-by date. Blurred though the distinction between judicial power and non-judicial power may be, there are some principled limits on the powers that can be conferred on Chapter 3 courts. There are a number of ways in which the powers conferred by Division 104 depart from the paradigm case of judicial power. In considering whether the legislation crossed the line, the majority judges approached their task piecemeal, finding precedents or analogies for each element of the legislation considered separately. I will argue that the majority should have considered the cumulative effect of the departures from the core exercise of judicial power. But first, I need to outline their analysis. It is clear that the task of the courts in making a control order is not to resolve a dispute between contesting parties as to existing rights and duties, but to impose new rights and duties. It has, however, been accepted that the creation of new rights and duties may be compatible with the exercise of judicial power. Chief Justice Gleeson made reference to cases of matrimonial causes, bankruptcy, probate, and the winding up of companies. A further Chapter 3 issue related to the imprecision of the legislative standards. The fact that the court has to be satisfied that the obligations, prohibitions, and restrictions to be imposed are reasonably necessary and reasonably appropriate and adapted for the purpose of protecting the public from a terrorist act. The majority judges conceded that the standards confer a wide discretion on courts, but thought that they are objectively ascertainable. They pointed out that courts frequently make judgments as to whether a measure is reasonably necessary or reasonably appropriate and adapted, work with broadly expressed standards, such as unreasonableness and injustice, and consider the protection of the public, for instance, in the sentencing context. Turning next to the fact that the rights and obligations created by control orders involve interfering with liberty on the basis of an assessment of future risk, rather than as an incident of judging criminal guilt, the majority pointed to other instances in which it is accepted that courts may exercise preventive powers, such as the granting of bail, the making of apprehended violence orders, and the traditional power to bind persons over to keep the peace. The majority also emphasized the point that, insofar as Lim's case suggests that legislation cannot require federal courts to detain individuals for preventive reasons, a matter left open in Farden, at least outside the sentencing context, control orders do not involve detention in custody. Finally, the majority held that issuing courts are not required to exercise power in a way contrary to Chapter 3. Subdivision B of Division 104 makes provision for interim control orders on the ex parte application of a senior AFP officer, while Subdivision D provides for a confirmation hearing. Chief Justice Gleeson noted that applications are made in open court, the rules of evidence apply, the applicant bears the burden of proof. Prior to the confirmation hearing, the controlled person is provided with relevant documents. The confirmation hearing involves evidence, cross-examination, and argument. The court has a discretion whether to revoke, vary, or confirm the order. An appeal lies in the ordinary way. And the court must consider the impact of the order on the subject's personal circumstances. One troubling aspect of Subdivision D is the fact that information may be withheld from the controlled person on ground of national security. The majority did not rule on the validity of this. It upheld Subdivision B only, saying that Subdivision D had not been engaged in respect of Thomas, who had challenged the legislation before his control order could be confirmed. I turn now to some commentary. I will argue first that the task imposed on judges by the legislation is not sufficiently constrained by pre-existing law and is therefore closer to a political task than a legal task. And secondly, that the legislation enlists courts in projects of social control which are at odds with their character and purpose. Lon Fuller's analysis of the nature of law is helpful in elucidating the nature of a legal task. Fuller explains that law is distinguished from the exercise of arbitrary power by its purpose. This is to subject our conduct to the governance of rules. It follows that if the legislator wishes to control behavior by legal means, it must enact rules which are clear enough to constrain the reasoning of the judges who must apply them. If the legislator's rules are so open-ended that it is impossible to predict how courts will apply them, then courts will not have been enlisted in the task of guiding behavior according to rules. Judges empowered to act on their own views have been given a political task, that of deciding what outcome they think best, not the legal task of applying pre-existing standards. Of course, the line between legal and political decision-making is not a bright-line distinction. It nevertheless remains true that legal decision-making involves a distinctive kind of reasoning which is more objective and more predictable than political decision-making. Legislators make their own independent moral and political assessments, unconstrained by the decisions of their predecessors or other authoritative decision-makers. Judges are in a different position. Adjudication involves, by definition, what John Finnis describes as some submerging of the judge's mind in favor of the communities. Does the control order regime submerge the judge's own mind sufficiently to entitle us to call the task it gives judges an act of judging? The Thomas majority answered yes, relying on other cases which upheld conferrals of power in very broad terms. But were these cases really similar? Consider, for instance, the powers granted to the state supreme courts, which were upheld in the case of Kaminos. The legislation empowered such a court, I quote, to make such maintenance order as it thinks proper, having regard to the means, earning capacity, and conduct of the parties to the marriage and all other relevant circumstances, and to require the parties to the marriage to make settlements of property, which it considered just and equitable in the circumstances. Although these provisions enabled such a court to create new rights and duties and conferred wide discretionary powers on it, the Comnenus Court pointed out respects in which the powers had a judicial character. Firstly, they were to be exercised in the course of a controversy between parties. They were in ancillary to the jurisdiction to hear and determine matrimonial causes. Secondly, the provisions did not free the court to give effect to its own idiosyncratic conceptions of justice, or to act on broad policy considerations unrelated to the facts of the case, or to what was appropriate to the means, interests, and needs of the parties to and children of the marriage. Likewise, the phrase just and equitable was not, it was said, a matter of unfettered individual opinion, but a traditional and relatively determinate judicial concept. It seems then that in Comnenus, wide powers were upheld because other, more traditional features of judicial power were present to offset the imprecision of the legislative standards. But there are no such countervailing features in Division 104. First, the power conferred is not ancillary to the exercise of power which is clearly judicial. Secondly, the courts must consider the protection of the public, a very different standard from standards like reasonableness, fairness, justice, and equity. Though these standards are broad, they are susceptible to incremental elaboration, lending themselves to the formulation of more specific rules to confine the exercise of discretion in future cases. Furthermore, they are used to resolve a dispute between identifiable individuals, not to make a decision for the good of society. Finally, judges have a shared understanding of their evaluative content. They therefore have a legal character. The protection of the public, by contrast, is a much more indeterminate and empirical standard, which is less suited to judicial decision-making and allows more scope for subjective and unpredictable judgments. Both Justice Kirby and Justice Hayne made these points. Although, as Professor Leslie Zine says, the principle that a court can only apply standards that are ascertainable is a matter of degree, there must exist a point at which the line between the ascertainable and the unascertainable gets crossed. In his analysis of the concept of discretion, Kent Greenewalt describes the spectrum of possibilities. At one end, there is simple factual judgment. In the middle, difficult judgments are required, but we still think that only one decision can be considered proper. At the other end, the standards are so open-ended that more than one choice is justified. Greenewalt gives the example of a teacher told to pick the 10 pupils to watch a Shakespeare play who would get the most out of it. Although this precludes many grounds of decision, for instance, choosing the pupils the teacher likes best, one teacher could justifiably decide to take the pupils who will best understand the play, while another might equally justifiably decide to take the pupils who have had least exposure to such plays. There is no basis for saying that one choice is right and the other wrong. Likewise, in my view, when courts are required to make such complex factual assessments as to whether a control order is reasonably necessary and reasonably appropriate and adapted to protect the public from a terrorist act, taking into account, to an extent which the legislation does not specify, the impact of the order on the person's circumstances, we have moved some distance from the relatively objective realm of judgment into a more subjective realm. The considerable uncertainty attached to assessing the risk of a terrorist act if certain precautions are not taken suggests that on the same facts, one court could reasonably find that a control order was necessary, while another could just as reasonably disagree. If so, the legislative criteria are not well suited to submerge the judge's mind, and the task imposed on judges is closer to a political task. I turn now to the preventive aspects of the control order regime. As we have seen, the majority pointed to other instances in which courts exercise preventive powers, such as the making of apprehended violence orders. But does the control order power occupy the same position on the spectrum as the offered examples? Once again, the fact that we are dealing with matters of degree does not mean that at some point the line does not get crossed. Suppose, for instance, that in turbulent times it would help to avert a riot if innocent members of a disliked minority were to be subjected to burdensome restrictions on their liberty simply to placate an incensed majority. could federal judges be directed to restrict their liberty? This seems unlikely. We reject the idea that this could be a judicial task because the minority's liberty is being restricted for reasons which have nothing to do with the danger posed by its members, let alone one created by their own past conduct. The only consideration on the basis of which they must forfeit their liberty is the protection of the public. And it is difficult to accept that judicial power could be enlisted in such a frankly utilitarian project, one which is willing, in a matter so fundamental as their liberty, to use people as a mere means to the ends of others, to use Kant's phrase. By contrast, in the majority's examples of preventive orders, those whose liberty is restricted are not victims of such a utilitarian exercise. As Justice Kirby observed, in these cases, the order is often ancillary to other proceedings and or is directed at protecting an identifiable individual, not society at large. Crucially, it is the past conduct of the person which leads to the order being made, and the order is made to restrain a breach of the law by that person or is at least directed against what they are likely to do. Since the restrictions on their liberty are triggered by their own dangerous past conduct, conduct which they would have known could lead to the use of state force against them and which they could have avoided, it cannot be said that they have been used to protect the safety of the public. This offsets the fact that judges are restricting liberty for non-punitive purposes and supports the conclusion that the task is sufficiently judicial. Control orders, however, are more like my hypothetical example. Control orders may be made to prevent harmful conduct on the part of someone whose past conduct gives no reason to think that they present a danger. Suppose, for example, that the authorities have evidence that there is a cell of terrorists in a block of flats, but do not know in which flat the terrorists live. They also have evidence that the cell is planning an attack. Might it not be thought necessary to impose control orders on all the people who live in the block in order to prevent the attack? If this seems far-fetched, we should not forget that similar reasoning was used to justify wartime detentions. Japanese Americans, for instance, were detained not on the basis of an individualized assessment of the risk they posed, but on the basis that their membership of a particular ethnic group made them more likely to commit acts of treason. The control order legislation opens the door to using membership of a group as a predictor of risk in just this way. By contrast, the United Kingdom control order legislation provides that there must be some evidence that the controlled person has been involved in terrorism-related activity. Indeed, in terms of Division 104, a control order need not even be directed at preventing the controlled person from causing harm. As Justice Kirby noted, it may be directed at what third parties might do. By contrast, once again, the obligations imposed by a UK control order must be considered necessary for purposes connected with preventing or restricting involvement by that individual in terrorism-related activity. The upshot, as Justice Kirby said, is that Division 104 makes it possible for judges to, I quote, deprive individuals of their freedoms because doing so conduces to the desired control of others, not a function, he said, hitherto regarded as proper to the powers vested in the Australian judiciary. With respect, this seems right. At the heart of the judicial task is the just treatment of individuals as individuals. Though courts may take into account the protection of society, it is not their normal function to restrict liberty without considering whether someone is individually dangerous to society. This feature of the control order regime is even more troubling when one considers the potentially onerous nature of the restrictions, which may be equivalent to a criminal penalty, and the fact that breach of an order is a criminal offence, punishable with up to 5 years imprisonment. The High Court accepted at face value the government's claim that the goal of the legislation is protective, but severe restrictions and a severe penalty for breach arguably suggest a measure which is punitive in substance. Similar arguments have been made about antisocial behaviour orders in the United Kingdom. But if control orders have a punitive dimension, then there is even more reason to think that the legislation confers non-judicial power. At least this would be so in respect of its conferral of power to make an order merely on the basis that to do so would substantially assist in preventing a terrorist act. This is because courts could not be authorized in the exercise of federal judicial power to punish individuals, not for their own risky conduct, but so as to prevent other individuals from committing harmful acts. Finnis observes that law, I quote, law brings definition, specificity, clarity, and thus predictability into human interactions, and that it provides a normative direction to citizens. The control order regime does not do this. It requires the courts to create new rights and obligations by reference to criteria which give little guidance, and a citizen would be hard-pressed to predict how they will be applied in practice. This concern is heightened given the liberty interest at stake. Clarity would normally be regarded as paramount when the consequences are so serious. And matters are further aggravated by the fact that control orders are not necessarily based on a person's past conduct. As a result, avoiding a control order may be outside a person's power. As Richard Bellamy observes, one can avoid falling foul even of a tyrant's law if the tyrant's rules are known and can be followed. The same is unfortunately not true of the control order regime. These factors interact to magnify the unfamiliarity of the task. The regime, therefore, does not, in my view, provide for the legal ordering of conduct. In addition to these conceptual issues, the legislation threatens the purposes which lie behind the separation of judicial power. I won't have time to go into all the issues, but I should mention Chief Justice Gleeson's argument that it is better from the human rights perspective that the power to make control orders be given to independent and impartial courts than to the executive. This view is attractive, and it is true that the public is likely to feel reassured that the task has been given to judges. The benefits may, however, prove short-lived. For one thing, it is not certain that judges will make an independent assessment of risk. To assume they will may overlook the heightened atmosphere of fear created by terrorism. His Honour's reasoning may also underestimate the deference judges generally accord the government's judgment on issues of national security. Indeed, the difficulty of testing intelligence information may make deference inevitable. Justice Hayne thought that the courts will, in practice, be forced to accept the government's view of the intelligence material. This, he said, will lead the judiciary to be seen as an instrument of the political branches of government and threaten the court's reputation as independent arbiters of the law. More generally, the judiciary enjoys the reputation for independence and impartiality that it does because judges are confined to specialized legal functions. In using the judiciary to perform a function which is at best marginally legal, the control order regime blurs the institutional differences between the judiciary and the political branches of government. In the long run, the use of the courts to restrict the liberty of individuals for the purpose of protecting the public may therefore kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
Our next paper deals with the Albaran and Alinta cases on the constitutionality of tribunals. The presenter is Emma Armson, who is on our program sheet as a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Law at the University of Sydney. But I believe, as some of us do from time to time, she's currently moonlighting at the ANU. She's been at Sydney since July 2002. Before that, she had wide experience in corporate law, including a term as a senior federal government policy officer on corporate law reform. But she's also been at Minters, at Westpac Financial Services, and at CCH. Her main interests are in takeover law and policy, and she's written several articles on the takeovers panel. But today it's those tribunals that she's talking about.
Thank you, Tony. As mentioned, I will be giving my presentation on the constitutionality of the Companies, Auditors and Liquidators Disciplinary Board in Albaran's case, and also on the Takeovers Panel in Alinta. I will focus predominantly on the takeovers panel, as the High Court's reasons in Alinta were delivered last week. As you can imagine, I've had a busy time since then. The decision in Oberon is comparatively more straightforward. We have joint reasons from six judges and Justice Kirby agreeing with the key reasoning in the joint reasons. Although the High Court was unanimous in its orders in Alinta, the reasons comprise six separate judgments. Interestingly, Justices Crennan and Kiefel are the only joint judgment, and also Justice Hayden agreed with Justice Finkelstein, who was in the minority in the full federal court. In addition to their own observations, another three judges agreed to various degrees with others in the court. Chief Justice Gleeson and Justice Gummow agreed with Justices Hayne, Crennan and Kiefel, and Justice Kirby agreed with the various considerations referred to by his colleagues and by Justice Finkelstein in the full federal court. This is in addition to his own observations. So as you can imagine, this makes the ratio arising from Alinta difficult to identify. The cases are significant as there are a number of commercial law bodies that raise the issue of separation of powers under Chapter 3 of the Constitution. As mentioned in the first session, there was a challenge to ASIC's, that's the regulator in corporate law, ASIC's power to disqualify persons from managing companies in Visnik last year. There's also the case of Breckler, which looked at a challenge to the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal, and that had some similarities with the takeovers panel, in which the majority of the full federal court had struck down the body, and then the High Court had found that its powers were not invalid. And finally, there was also a constitutional challenge that was unsuccessful to the previous incarnation of the takeovers panel, and that's in the Precision Data case. So this is an overview of my presentation. I'll firstly give you an overview on the High Court's decisions in Oberon and Alinta. Secondly, I'll discuss the key features of the disciplinary board, the provision under challenge, and also the reasons why the board was found not to be exercising judicial power. Thirdly, there will be a similar analysis in relation to the takeovers panel, focusing on the changes to the panel since Precision Data and the key indicia of judicial power relied upon by the High Court. And finally, I'll finish with some concluding observations. As you would be aware, the key issue was whether there was a breach of the separation of powers brought about by Chapter 3 of the Commonwealth Constitution, preventing the Parliament from giving judicial power to a body other than a court. And one of the key reasons for this is to protect the independence of the judiciary, and this is discussed in detail by Justice Kirby in Oberon's case. So the key question before both, in relation to both decisions, was whether the bodies were exercising judicial power. The High Court, in its decision on the disciplinary board in Oberon in May of last year, dismissed an appeal from a unanimous full federal court decision. Both decisions had found that the board was not purporting to exercise judicial power. In Alinta, the majority of the full federal court in April last year, so the full federal court's decision was before the High Court's decision in Oberon, and Justice Holmes very usefully outlined the key reasoning given by the majority and minority in the full court this morning. The majority of the full federal court declared a key part of the panel's jurisdiction to be invalid, and this is the provision that allowed it to exercise powers based upon contraventions of the Corporations Act. So for nearly 8 months, the takeovers panel couldn't accept applications on this basis. In its orders in December last year, the High Court allowed an appeal from the full federal court decision, and it declared the provision not invalid. As indicated earlier, the reasons were handed down last week. As its name suggests, the board's role is to discipline auditors and liquidators by cancelling their registration where they have failed to carry out their duties adequately and properly. Both auditors and liquidators play an important role in ensuring the integrity of the corporate law system. Auditors are responsible for checking the accuracy of companies' financial statements, and liquidators manage the financial affairs of a company in the winding up process. Unlike for the takeovers panel since the 2000 reforms, applications to the board can only be made by the corporate regulator, being ASIC, and in the case of auditors, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority. Board member qualifications are similar as for those for the panel, except for the requirements that the chairperson and deputy chair be lawyers, and also a significant proportion of the members are accountants nominated by accounting bodies. The other members are appointed based upon their knowledge or experience in business or commerce, administration of companies, financial services, economics or law. This slide sets out the provision that was under challenge. The disciplinary board in two matters in question determined that the liquidators had failed under section 1292, subsection 2, paragraph D, subparagraph 2, to perform adequately and properly the duties and functions required by Australian law to be performed by a registered liquidator. In Precision Data, the High Court referred to the difficulty of framing a definition of judicial power that is at once exclusive and exhaustive. As you would be aware, in this, the cases in this area set out a series of propositions, with no one factor or series being conclusive. This allows for flexibility and value judgments, but makes outcomes very difficult to predict. All of the High Court judges in Oulburn agreed with the attorney's submission that the cases focus on the manner of the exercise of the power, its subject matter, and the purposes and consequences of its decision. In Oulburn, the appellants argued that the board orders effectively involved an adjudication on the right to be registered, and that the board determined wrongdoing and imposed punishment. The key findings leading to the High Court finding that the board did not exercise judicial power were that, firstly, the board lacks the power to enforce its decisions, and that enforcement of its orders required the exercise of court jurisdiction. Secondly, that the board did not determine whether persons committed an offence. And thirdly, that there was not an enforcement of an existing right or liability. The reasoning for this was that any opinion on existing rights was only a step to the board's conclusion on whether the person adequately and properly fulfilled their duties. The majority joint reasons referred to the fact that this term imported notions of judgment by reference to professional standards. The other factors upon which the High Court referred to was the board membership and also the discretionary power relating to whether or not the respondent was a fit and proper person. Interestingly, Justice Kirby noted that the courts might have been deployed for the board's task, but that it was not necessary for the court to do it. His Honour referred to the board as an unremarkable disciplinary institution. The Takeovers Panel is a body that was established in 1991, and its primary role is to enforce the spirit of the takeover provisions. Briefly, these are to ensure an efficient, competitive, and informed market, and that there is enough time, information, and a reasonable and equal opportunity for shareholders to participate in the benefits under a takeover. The panel can make a declaration of unacceptable circumstances and orders if there is a breach of the spirit of the provisions. The panel was given new powers in 2000 to provide a more effective response to the commercial issues in takeovers, so that they are resolved efficiently and shareholders can decide the takeover on its merits. There was a concern that court proceedings could be used to block the bid. Accordingly, Section 659AA set out the object of the amendments, and that is that the takeover panel be the main forum for resolving takeover disputes until the bid period is ended. And the majority of the full federal court referred to this provision in their view that the provision was, that the takeover's powers were invalid. To achieve this, there were a number of changes to the legislation, and one of the key ones was the fact that the court's jurisdiction is limited during the takeover bid period, so that only applications under Section 75 or applications by ASIC or other government authorities can be made in that time period. The court's powers after the bid were also limited if the panel refuses to make a declaration of unacceptable circumstances. The jurisdiction of the panel was opened up so that any person whose interests are affected by the circumstances could apply to the panel. And as I've noted earlier, the panel has similar member qualifications to the disciplinary board and also to the panel prior to the 2000 changes. This is the provision that was subject to constitutional challenge, paragraph B of section 657 capital A. This provision has since been amended. It is now paragraph C, but there were only minor changes made to it to add the past and future tense. So the provision that you have here in a substance is the one that applies now. This allows the takeovers panel to make a declaration of unacceptable circumstances if it appears those circumstances are unacceptable because they constitute contravention of the Act provisions dealing with takeovers, compulsory acquisitions, rights and liabilities, and ownership information. Importantly, subsection 2 contains an additional requirement, and that is that the takeovers panel may only make a declaration if it considers that doing so is not against the public interest, after taking into account any policy considerations that it considers relevant. I will focus now on the following key factors from the High Court cases on the nature of judicial power. And that's firstly, whether the body makes a binding and authoritative decision, whether it determines existing legal rights or instead takes into account policy considerations, and thirdly, looking at the subject matter of its decisions and the nature of the body. The first factor, being a binding and authoritative decision, is the traditional starting point in determining the meaning of judicial power. As you would be aware, this is the power to decide controversies between subjects, and that this doesn't begin until a binding and authoritative decision is made. In the legislation, non-compliance with a takeovers panel order is a strict liability offence. However, an application to the court is needed to enforce those orders, and the court has the power to make any orders considered appropriate to secure compliance with a panel order. All of the Alinta judges, either in their own reasons or agreeing, found that the panel did not make a binding and authoritative decision. And that's because their decisions are enforced by the courts in the exercise of the court's judicial power. Six of the judges referred to the fact that the takeovers panel does not enforce its own orders, and also that the panel cannot direct a person to comply with the Act. Five of the judges' reasonings referred to the panel decision as being the criterion or factum by which the rights and obligations became enforceable. That is, that the panel's decision is the criteria for the application of the legal norms and remedies in the legislation. And this is similar to the arguments used in Brickler. The second factor, whether or not the panel is enforcing existing legal rights, was the key issue, I think, determining this case in favour of the Takeovers Panel. And the reason, supported by six of the judges, placed particular emphasis on the Tasmanian Breweries Test. And I've summarised that in the slide, that the judicial process involves an inquiry concerning the law and facts as they are, followed by an application of the law to the facts. Five of the judges supported the findings that the Takeovers Panel creates rights and obligations through its orders. Similarly, six of the judges referred to the fact that the Takeovers Panel's orders prevented the consequences of unacceptable circumstances, and they were not to observe the rights and obligations arising from the breach. All of the judges referred to Section 657, capital A, subsection 3, which contains requirements that the panel take into account policy considerations. So paragraph A requires the panel to take into account the purposes of the provisions, which I referred to earlier, and paragraph B allows the Takeovers Panel to have regard to any other matter that it considers relevant. As you can see, it's a very broad discretion. Consequently, all of the judges considered that more than a contravention was needed for a declaration of unacceptable circumstances. Interestingly, Chief Justice Gleeson and Justice Kirby also focused on the suitability of the courts compared to the Takeovers Panel in dealing with takeovers matters. Chief Justice Gleeson noted that there was a long history of finding non-judicial power if the power was intended to be based upon general policy considerations and with an expediency that is alien to the judicial method. Chief Justice Gleeson stated that the courts were ill-adapted to take account of the considerations and interests that the panel was required to consider. His Honour noted that judges are appointed based on their legal knowledge and experience, and that their other talents, whatever they may be, are not assessed. His Honour referred to the constraints of the adversarial setting, which impose limits on the information upon which the court may proceed, and also found that there was not judicial power here due to the constitution of the panel, among other things. And as I've mentioned, the members of the panel are appointed based upon their knowledge and experience in areas such as business, accounting and economics. Justice Kirby similarly thought that the courts were deficient in dealing with takeover disputes due to the court's composition, their appeal provisions, procedures, and the scope for collateral challenge. Justice Kirby also emphasised that the Act requires the panel to address broad policy criteria more appropriate for an administrative body. In conclusion, there are similar key reasoning in the two cases, but more wieldy reasons for the decision in Alinta. While you might expect some clarity with the unanimous outcome in Alinta, typical of this area, the predictive value of the case is limited. And this is because it's difficult to establish principles for the future due to the differing reasons. Notwithstanding this, the outcome of the cases provides a clear victory for both tribunals. There was unanimous support of their not exercising judicial power, and they are in the clear on this important question. Given the novel nature of the panel, the Takeovers Panel, it is possible that there might be other challenges made. It has an as yet unused rulemaking power, and the time limitations in the privative clause are also unusual. Although four judges in Alinta refer to the fact that the limitations on the court are only temporary. So although the arguments on these points may not be strong, there may be some incentive to bring a case even if it's not ultimately successful. And this is due to the strategic advantages of commercial litigation, where you have parties with both money and motivation to challenge decisions in the courts. However, the decisions in Alboran and Alinta demonstrate the difficulties involved in getting the High Court to strike down commercial tribunals.
Like Anne Toomey this morning, Graham Hill is stepping in at very short notice, and we're very grateful to him for it. But like her, he's a well-known performer on this and similar platforms. He's at the bar in Melbourne, particularly in public law cases, but before that he'd been working for as a Commonwealth lawyer for 12 years, including 6 years ago. He had a stint as counsel assisting the Commonwealth Solicitor General. 10 years ago, a stint as associate to Justice Hayne, and consistently with all of that, he's published widely in constitutional and administrative law with a particular interest in issues of federal jurisdiction. And today he's talking on the scope of Section 75.5, particularly in relation to the Bodjiratsa case.
Thanks, Tony. Listening to my CV put in chronology form makes me think I should really do something a bit more recent than 6 years and 10 years ago. Anyway, Bodjiratsa. The issue was whether the Commonwealth could impose an 84-day time limit for bringing judicial review proceedings in the High Court's original jurisdiction, and the High Court said no. Now, it, of course, forms part of a long list of cases in which one way of putting it, I don't ascribe this way of putting it to the Commonwealth, of course, is to say the Commonwealth jousting with the High Court as to who's controlling the show, and, of course, the answer is the High Court. But so, for example, back in the mid-90s, the Commonwealth tried limiting the grounds on which migration decisions could be reviewed in the federal court, and then in 2001, in the Yusuf case, the High Court construed those provisions in a way that pretty much rendered them meaningless. So the High Court tried a sort of Hickman privative clause that applied to to review in all courts, and as is well known in Plaintiff S157, that was construed in a way that made it pretty well worthless because review is still available for jurisdictional error, so you had to go through the exercise of, well, is there jurisdictional error or not? And about that time, the Commonwealth also introduced time limits. So there's three time limits in the Migration Act. There's one that applies to proceedings in the Federal Magistrates Court, one that applies to proceedings in the Federal Court, and one that applies to proceedings in the High Court. So Bodjiratsa is about that last one, proceedings in the High Court, and it's it's Section 486 capital A of the Migration Act. And it says if you want to apply to the High Court for a remedy in relation to a migration decision, you have to apply within 28 days with provision to have that period extended to 56 for a further 56 days. So that's where you get the 84-day time limit. But significantly, once that 84-day time limit has expired, the Act expressly says the High Court shall not make an order extending time. So it's that aspect, the non-extendable nature of the time limit, that was under challenge. What I'll do is just start with the High Court's reasoning, and depending on how we go for time, give you a few of my thoughts on the broad implications of the decision. So let me just make sure I've read it out right. 486A1s impose a time limit on the application, quote, for a remedy to be granted in exercise of the court's original jurisdiction in relation to a migration decision. So strictly speaking, that could apply to either 75.3 or 75.5, but obviously most of the review is taking place under 75.5. An interesting side note, in Plaintiff S157, you might remember the court interpreted decision to mean, to say that it couldn't possibly mean a invalid decision, and interestingly the Act had since been amended to include a purported decision. So the Commonwealth basically put forward two arguments to try to defend the validity of this time limit. One is to say, even though it looks like a time limit, limiting your ability to bring proceedings, what in fact it is a provision that validates administrative decisions. Now, you might remember with Hickman Clause, there used to be this debate, you know, is it a limit on the court's jurisdiction, or in fact, is it a provision that expands the scope of the decision-maker's powers? And we all know how that turned out in Plaintiff S157. Notwithstanding that, the Commonwealth still persevered with that line of argument as the first line of defence in Bodrodaza, and it didn't work. One difficulty for the Commonwealth with this line of argument is that if a time limit really does validate an administrative decision, it'd be effective for all sorts of proceedings brought in relation to the decision, not just judicial review proceedings. So you can imagine situations where you might bring a challenge, say a private law action for a trespass or some sort of tort that depends on establishing that a migration decision is invalid, because then you can say, whatever, there's no lawful authority for the decision. So for the Commonwealth's validation theory to work, this 84-day time limit would have to apply to that sort of tort action as well as a judicial review action. So the High Court clearly didn't want to find that at all. It actually called that legislative intention draconian, if not irrational. And they said, well, if you want to do that, you have to say so in clear words, and not only are they not clear words, but in fact the extrinsic materials go the other way. So the High Court didn't accept that this was a provision that applied to all challenges. They said, no, it only applies to judicial review challenges, and for various textual reasons, they said, it's clear. It's not a provision that validates decisions. It's a limit on the court's jurisdiction. So just put that more carefully in the way the High Court put it. They concluded that Section 486A attempted to deny the competency of applications to the High Court brought under Section 75.5 of the Constitution. So, as we all know, when you are reading through a judgment for the first time and you see that's the way that they characterise the provision you're trying to defend, you think things are not going well, and they weren't. So, talking about validity, the basic issue, of course, is that the original jurisdiction granted by Section 75 of the Constitution doesn't depend on Commonwealth legislation to confer. It's conferred by the Constitution itself. So, of course, Commonwealth legislation can't abrogate it. And so what the Commonwealth, the second line of defence of the Commonwealth was, OK, even if this provision is a time limit, it is a mere reasonable regulation of the court's jurisdiction. And that's not a completely stupid argument, because the High Court, of course, regulates its own jurisdiction under the High Court rules. Those High Court rules are made under a provision of the High Court Act. So in that sense, the Commonwealth does have legislative power to regulate the exercise of the High Court's jurisdiction. So it is clear there's some power to regulate. The question is this a permissible regulation, this 84-day time limit, or is it an impermissible restriction, abrogation of the court's jurisdiction? So the plaintiff in Bodrodaza had two arguments. One was quite an ambitious point, which was to say a non-extendable time limit, you remember this time limit here is non-extendable, is always contrary to Section 75.5 of the Constitution, because an essential element of the constitutional terms prohibition, mandamus, injunction is that they're discretionary remedies. So this ambitious argument was it was essential that the court always have power, have discretion whether or not to grant the remedies a fixed time that was contrary to that. Now, the High Court said it didn't need to rule on that ambitious argument, though, as I'll show, it actually came pretty close to accepting it. Instead, they posed this test, and once again, I'd better read it out to make sure I get it right. A time limit cannot, either directly or as a matter of practical effect, so curtail the right of applicants to seek relief as to be inconsistent with the place of Section 75.5 in the constitutional structure. So I was reading a comment, and that said that test is a little bit circular in the sense that when is a time limit invalid or when it's contrary to the purpose of Section 75.5, so you think, well, what is the purpose of Section 75.5? And so elsewhere in the judgment, the court, as you'd expect, refers to the important role that Section 75.5 plays in upholding the rule of law. And so we'll all remember paragraphs 103 and 104 of Plaintiff S157 referring to Dixon's judgment in the Communist Party case about the Constitution being formed on the assumption of the rule of law and 75.5 being a textual confirmation of that. And so, of course, that's what the High Courts relied on here to say. The purpose of Section 75.5 is to uphold the rule of law. And they say, well, how does this time limit affect that purpose? And in argument, an example used by the Chief Justice in Plaintiff S157 was raised, where His Honour said, sometimes, say if a decision is procured by fraud, you don't become aware of the error until quite a lot later after the decision. And so the Commonwealth was forced to accept, yes, this time limit would sometimes prevent a person from seeking review of a decision, even though there was no way of them knowing that a decision was procured by fraud until after the time limit had already expired. So that's a very, very unattractive argument for the Commonwealth to have to put. And so the court, of course, could think of any number of examples where this time limit would prevent judicial review in circumstances where you think, well, judicial review would be very important there. So pretty much for that reason, the High Court has said this fixed time limit, which operates on the date of notification of a decision, is invalid. And they said the time limit's invalid, it's wholly invalid, no scope for reading down. The reason I just mention that is that there's perhaps a slightly puzzling aspect of the judgment. So the court's just said the time limit's wholly invalid, but then they go on to say, ask themselves this, I think, very interesting question for us federal jurisdiction tragics. Could the Commonwealth validly limit the ability of the High Court to grant certiorari as ancillary relief in Section 75.5 proceedings? You know, very interesting sort of stuff. But you think, well, why does it matter if the time limit that you're considering is invalid? Anyway, this is what the High Court said, is that, no, the Commonwealth cannot. The Commonwealth cannot take away the High Court's power to grant certiorari as ancillary relief in Section 75.5 proceedings, because that is to deny the court's ability, effective exercise of that jurisdiction. And I think, well, it's one of those, passages put in to sort of encourage the Commonwealth not to head down a certain direction, and I'll come back to it in just a second. You might remember that it's a judicial review proceeding, so of course, you know, this question about whether, in fact, a decision was had a jurisdictional error, it didn't. So it was very good for Mr. Bodridaza to have his case test this issue of the time. Unfortunately for him, the decision itself was valid, so I'm not sure what's happened to him. But just thinking about sort of pulling back from the position of him, just what are the broader implications of this case? One is just the extent to which the Commonwealth can regulate bringing judicial review proceedings. So one obvious issue is there's three time limits in the Migration Act. Bodridaza said the one that applies to the High Court's invalid. What, if anything, does it have to say about the time limits that apply to the Federal Magistrates Court and the Federal Court? Now, when I was researching this paper, I noticed there was a few Federal Court cases saying, well, in fact, it says nothing. But I'm told by someone here that there's a full court reserved on that question, so perhaps I shouldn't say anything more on that, just to say that's an issue. Thinking about the High Court, I mentioned earlier the court came very close to accepting that the Commonwealth can never impose a strict time limit in the sense of a non-extendable time limit on judicial review proceedings in its original jurisdiction. This is what they said. Any attempt to enact a rule that precludes what is considered by the legislature to be an untimely application for what, by hypothesis, is a discretionary remedy is bound to encounter constitutional difficulties. So that's a pretty big hint for the Commonwealth that fixed time limits aren't going to work. Having said that, as I said, some limits, there must be some limits. So what sort of limits or what sort of approach do we think the High Court's going to take? And here's where I think that discussion of certiorari is very interesting and very revealing. You might remember I said the High Court said the Commonwealth cannot take away the High Court's power to grant certiorari as an ancillary remedy in 75(5) proceedings, because that would be to deny the court the effective exercise of jurisdiction. What I want to just pause here is to say, well, let's really test that. A certiorari, of course, quashes a decision. When you're reviewing a decision of an administrative body, if the High Court declares that there's a jurisdictional error, the decision is taken to be no decision at all. That's what Bardwaj says. In fact, if there's a jurisdictional error, you don't even need judicial review proceedings for there to be no decision at all. That's what Bardwaj says. So if we were talking about what is strictly necessary for the High Court to have in order to conduct 75(5) proceedings, you might say, well, do you need certiorari when you're conducting review of administrative decisions? Now, of course, that still leaves the position of when the officer of the Commonwealth is a member of a superior court. Still, that's a very much more limited proposition than you always need to have certiorari to make effective the exercise of 75(5) jurisdiction. Now, I'm sure there's any number of judicial officers in the room who might disagree with what I've just said. Let me put it this way. The High Court's approach, I think, suggests they're going to take a very, very demanding view of any Commonwealth law that purports to limit the High Court's 75(5) jurisdiction. So I guess we'd say, well, of course. But in some contexts, you'd say the test would be something like, does the Commonwealth law substantially impair? Does it negate the exercise of jurisdiction? I think this discussion of certiorari shows the High Court's got a very, very much more demanding test in mind than that. And we were talking about Roach earlier today, and I think it was Graham Moore who talked about strict scrutiny. One thing that's always interested me in Australian constitutional law is how we haven't really articulated a standards of review, because in America, they've got some contexts that say deserve strict scrutiny, some they say a rational review basis. One thing that's interesting in Australia is it's not articulated in that way, but often I think when you have judicial power questions, the court engages often in what you might call strict scrutiny. I think this is the sort of thing we've just seen with 75(5). If the Commonwealth wants to enact a law affecting, limiting the exercise of the High Court's jurisdiction, the court will look very, very seriously at it and require a very, very high degree of fit. On the other hand, in the implied freedom cases, maybe not Roach, but many of the implied freedom cases, the court seems to take a much more relaxed approach to say, well, if there's a good reason for it, say Mulholland, if there's a good reason for it, then that's good enough. And all I want to say, this is probably a whole paper in itself, there's an interesting question whether that difference of approach is a good idea or not. Anyway, so far, just thinking about the implications of Bodrodaza, I've just been thinking about regulating proceedings in the High Court, particularly judicial review proceedings. Another thing that's interesting, it's a related issue to the issue in Bodrodaza, is when the Commonwealth tries to impose a limitation period on private law actions against it, or Commonwealth or state, particularly when the private law action depends on establishing constitutional invalidity of something. So you remember British American Tobacco, a company wants to get money back from the state that was imposed due to invalid tax. British American Tobacco was about the right to proceed, but could the state have imposed a limitation period on the right to bring that action? And there's old cases like Antill, Ranger and Barton, which seem to suggest that a reasonable limitation period, particularly one that doesn't distinguish or privilege actions against the government, might apply validly to causes of action even when the cause of action depends on establishing constitutional invalidity. It's interesting. I don't think Bodrodaza affects those old cases, because on the one hand, Bodrodaza does have this very strong statement about the rule of law. And if you think, oh, well, if that's right, then surely that applies to private law actions just as much as it applies to judicial review actions. On the other hand, the court also expressly says, well, we know that there's these limitation periods, but that's just a different context. They don't have anything to say about judicial review actions. So that's an open question. So then, moving away from the Commonwealth attempting to limit proceedings against it or the states, what broader implications could we try to draw from Bodrodaza about constitutional interpretation more generally? And I had a few things, maybe just two of them worth mentioning. One is that I think constitutional interpretation is particularly difficult when the Constitution refers to a legal concept, because some of the things referred to in the Constitution have a physical existence, so they either exist or they don't, and you can kind of, you don't need the law to tell you what a lighthouse is. But when something's a legal concept, that's defined by law, always subject to legislative variation, it's very difficult to say, well, now it's in the Constitution, clearly something about it is fixed, but what is the essential, what are the essential characteristics of it? And that probably the area where it's come up most, I think, is in the trial by jury context. And James Stelios has done a lot of work on this, and I was chatting to him about this. And it seems that there's two trends in the way the High Court goes about it. One is to what you might call a bottom-up approach. They look at all the legislation that existed in the 19th century, sort of comb through agonisingly and say, can we deduce from that whether this particular thing was or wasn't an essential characteristic? Another approach, so that sort of thing, I think they didn't, the High Court didn't cheat, or, you know, is it unanimous jury an essential element? Another way of doing it is more reasoning from the top down, which you see in more recent jury cases. They say, well, what's the function of a jury? Oh, it's got to be representative, and I forget what the other ones are. Anyway, working from the top down, they say, well, is this thing essential in order to fulfil the function of a jury? The interesting thing in Bodridazza is the High Court, of course, as you expect, looks at it from both ways. There is a discussion of the English law about the prerogative writs, now the constitutional writs in Australia. But I think ultimately the key point for the court is more, well, what's the place of 75.5 in the constitutional structure? So in that sense, it's more that top-down reasoning that you see in cases like Brownlee about the trial by jury. And that brings me to the rule of law. And I hope this won't come across as too much of an ex-Commonwealth rant, but it may well. There's only two points to make about the rule of law and its use in Bodridazza. One is that, of course, as everyone in this room knows, the rule of law means different things in different contexts. You have the so-called procedural or thin conception of the rule of law, which is people must stay within the bounds of the authority given them by Parliament and the Parliament within the bounds of authority given by the Constitution. On the one hand, the thin conception, or the thick conception, where you start saying the rule of law requires that the law be a certain way. And the short point is that the further you get away from the narrow or thin conception of the rule of law, the more controversial it is. And on its surface, you'd be thinking, well, Graham, you can't possibly whinge about Bodridazza, because surely the court was talking about the rule of law and the thin conception. They're saying 75.5 requires that decision makers stay within the bounds of what the functions that Parliament have given them. All I'd say is, well, yes and no. I think it all turns on what view you take of the so-called jurisdictional errors. I say so-called only to the extent that some of them I don't think really have much to do with jurisdiction as it's ordinarily used. So I think, just to take a very important one, natural justice I don't think really has anything to do with jurisdiction. It's got everything to do with forming a valued judgment about what sort of government we want. And in saying it that way, I don't mean to take a position on the old debate about, well, what's the proper source of procedural fairness. I'm just saying I think a value judgment's been formed, and I think an entirely defensible and sound one, that there's a certain way that decisions should be made, but I don't think it really is anything to do with jurisdiction. And so my only point is that, to some extent at least, this rule of law here is not, as used to justify 75.5, is not really a thin conception of the rule, or it's a thick conception of the rule of law, but it's that potential controversy is disguised by the label given to these category of errors, of jurisdictional errors. And I'm not sure where that gets us. I can hardly see the headline being tomorrow, High Court suppresses controversial theory by, you know, incompletely theorising. I mean, it's not going to happen. But still, I think it's an interesting idea to think, when the High Court talks about the rule of law, exactly what do they mean by it, and how controversial is it? It's not that controversial now. I think it's much too widely accepted what 75.5 does, and the High Court's decision of Bodridazza, I think, is just an extension or even an application of what the High Court had already been saying. But just to conclude, I want to offer an intriguing alternative history that I fear will never actually happen in Australia. 75.5, of course, is constitutional ground of jurisdiction. What's interesting, though, is to think about Section 38E of the Judiciary Act, which makes the High Court's jurisdiction in those matters exclusive of the state courts. So back in 1903, there weren't any federal courts. So all these matters were going to be brought in the High Court. And I thought, I wonder why it was, given the volume of these sort of cases these days, that it was thought that these matters should only be brought in the High Court. And I looked up the second reading speech of the Judiciary Act, and Alfred Deakin saying, there's a few matters we've given exclusively to the High Court, the Commonwealth versus the states versus the states versus the Commonwealth, and judicial review proceedings. He said, these are likely to be very rare. Okay, perhaps not, but importantly, likely to be matters of high political controversy. So it's just interesting when you ask yourself a probably irrelevant question now, why did the framers put 75.5 in the Constitution? We always say, oh, because of Marbury and Madison. I don't think it was the principle of Marbury and Madison, which is the importance of judicial review. It was the facts of Marbury and Madison. Marbury and Madison's about James Madison, Secretary of State, refusing to hand over the commission to a person who was appointed judge under the previous outgoing government. And 75.5 is put in there to make sure Commonwealth officers perform duties under the Constitution, like hand over the surplus revenue. Anyway, that's not the purpose the High Court has been saying for the last however many years. It's probably much too entrenched to ever be changed, but I think it's an interesting possibility, and I hope there are some questions. I look forward to them. Thank you.
Now, I think there'll be questions and comments, and I think we have a roving microphone, although I can't at this moment see it. Now I can see it. Questions?
I've got a question for Emma Armson. Emma, after the two recent decisions, where do you see Brandy and the proposition that a decision that is of administrative character becomes judicial by registration of its order in the federal court, and how does it distinguish from the decision being a factum upon which an order of a federal court can be made?
Okay, both of those cases reinforce the view of Brandy as being a very separate case, that the legislation in Brandy specifically, through a process of registration, made the decision of the body an order of the court. So, in a way, the High Court, particularly in Linter, is moving along the lines of Breckler, which some may say is a very fine distinction, that they're saying that the panel makes a decision and then the legislation operates on that basis. So it is a fine distinction, but the High Court is continuing to move forward with that idea, that even though in relation to the panel, the orders of the panel... non-compliance was made a strict liability offence and the penalty was around $2,750. And even though you could apply to the court for enforcement, but the provision specifically says that the court has the power to enforce compliance of that order. So the full federal court's majority's view was that the court, when looking at the enforcement, had a very narrow jurisdiction. Despite that, the High Court has upheld this type of model, which is similar to in Olbrin's case. So I know we are dealing with fine distinctions, but essentially the High Court is continuing to uphold the Breckler-style model and setting apart Brandy as being a very special circumstance.
This is a question for Mr. Hill. Professor Toomey this morning said that Kirby has been criticising the High Court recently for basically making decisions that leave past authorities standing, you know, not taking the bold step of overruling things. And it's always been my view that Plaintiff S157, frankly, was a quite a gutless decision, basically didn't overrule the privative clause and so made it much more difficult to know what was going to be a jurisdictional error and to define what was now going to be a basis for taking a migration decision through the courts. Is that a fair comment, do you think? What do you think?
Well, what I think is that we shouldn't let David Bennett talk any more about Plaintiff S157 because he'll burst a blood valve. But it's definitely the case. I remember talking to the Commonwealth Junior Counsel in Plaintiff S157 and he thought that there was tension probably rising to level of actual contradiction between the High Court's approach to the Hickman Clause and particularly, you know, does it apply to purported decisions and would that be consistent with Section 75.5 and then Plaintiff S157? So the answer is I think, yeah, Plaintiff S157 probably did change, it certainly changed the Commonwealth's, or my understanding of what a Hickman Clause did. I'd always thought the analysis was it expanded the scope of a decision maker's power, but the High Court really doesn't seem to like that analysis but doesn't give you a very clear idea of what it is that it does. There's actually an interesting example of it. I wonder, when I was talking about certiorari and the High Court's 75.5 jurisdiction, I think there's a really interesting tension between the High Court's conclusions in that respect and the majority decision in Abebe. Now, they're distinguishable situations because Abebe is about confining the jurisdiction of lower courts. It's not about the High Court's constitutionally required jurisdiction. But definitely underlying the minority approach in Beebe is a theory that the effective exercise of judicial power requires that a court be able to dispose of the whole dispute. And that was a view that wasn't accepted by four members of the High Court. So it's interesting to see that sort of thinking coming out again in Bodra Daza. And I think you are getting to the situation that a similar sort of theory comes out in Justices Gordon and Gummo's judgment in Bardwaj, I think, or one of them, Arla or Bardwaj. And I think what you're starting to do is get a whole line of cases that don't mention a BB but can't easily be reconciled with a BB, and so eventually, when the issue does come up, there will be a very difficult decision for the High Court. What is the authoritative status of the majority decision in BB now?
Thanks. My question is to Emma. I'm wondering what you think about following Alinta and Albaran as to whether or not the Commonwealth may be encouraged to create tribunals in other areas of the law, and if so, which ones do you think there is a potential for expansion into, in other words, shifting jurisdiction away from the courts and towards administrative tribunals?
I'm sorry, my area of expertise is more corporate law, so I must say I focused more on the constitutionality of bodies within that area. Having said that, I think that the Takeovers Panel is quite an unusual body, possibly one of the high watermarks, I guess brandy aside. You have a body in which parties to a takeover can apply. You have the courts outside, sort of pushed to one side, and the full federal court was concerned about a judicial vacuum. And Justice Kirby acknowledges those concerns. So I guess it's hard to see how you would have a body that had more powers than the Takeovers Panel without the High Court having concerns. So I guess I see, and people in the commercial community breathed a sigh of relief after the High Court upheld the panel because the full federal court had struck it down. So I'm sorry, I don't have any thoughts as to how these powers may be used more broadly. As I mentioned, both Chief Justice Gleeson and Justice Kirby were particularly focusing on the fact that takeovers panels matters need involve broader considerations and involve short time periods. So there may be other areas, but I'm sorry, I haven't thought about that for the moment.
Another question? Yes.
Graham, I may have misunderstood a comment you made about natural justice not being query a jurisdictional error. I thought the High Court had decided in ex parte ala that it was, and that was the reason it had jurisdiction, and I'd be a bit concerned at the suggestion that a breach of natural justice wasn't a jurisdictional error, because you may then lose the whole of the opportunity to bring such actions.
Yeah, thanks. Obviously, I didn't make myself clear, so I'm grateful. You're 100% right. In fact, ALA is the starting point for my argument. On current authorities, the categories of jurisdictional error do include a breach of natural justice. My only point, and you may not agree with this, is that if you think about the ordinary language of jurisdiction, I don't think a breach of natural justice comes within jurisdictional error as you'd commonly think about what jurisdiction is. So I think the slippery nature of jurisdictional error is shown by the fact that some are described as constructive failures to exercise jurisdiction. As soon as you say that, you're acknowledging that the things you're calling jurisdictional error aren't really about jurisdiction properly so-called. So the way I think about it is to say, well, just substitute the word serious for jurisdictional. What does 75.5 give you review for? For serious errors. OK, well, that makes sense. Breach of natural justice is a serious error. You cannot let this decision stand that's got a breach of natural justice. And my only point was, when you think about the rule of law and the narrow conception, you're thinking about jurisdiction in the sort of ordinary, narrow sense. And some of the errors that are called jurisdictional, including breach of natural justice, are really going to the rule of law in a much more substantive, we're worried about the way decisions are made kind of sense. And there's an interesting quote in ALA where I think it's Justices Gordron and Gummo sort of float an argument that even when there's a non-statutory power, so you've just got an executive power, there might be an argument that's inherent in Chapter 2 of the Constitution that Commonwealth decision makers observe the requirements of procedural fairness. Now, that, I think, is pretty much what drives natural justice. There's just a judgment that we want a system of law where decision makers do certain things because that's what we expect. But it's not about jurisdiction as in an ordinary, narrow sense.
OK, we've probably got time for one more... a few more questions.
My question is for Denise, and I suppose it relates to some of the bigger questions as to how you actually now predict the outcomes of when judicial power is being exercised or not. I mean, Alinta is interesting that if you get right the enforcement point, which you can do in substance in a way that might look like judicial power, but nonetheless you can get around it, you're not going to have a problem there. Perhaps it comes down more to questions of whether policy or law is being exercised, yet I note that the public interest or words like it were used and deployed to exactly the opposite effect in Alinta as opposed to Mowbray and Thomas. In Alinta, of course, and the public interest was a key factor that judicial power is not being exercised, yet those same words in Thomas suddenly assumed legal criterion. So what is it that is actually determining these cases? I mean, when it gets down to the bottom level, what are the key factors? Is it just the indicia which perhaps just turn out differently in different cases, or is it something more substantive? Is it, for example, my instinctive sense that the court is taking a look at these bodies and determining that, well, this really does look like something that should be done by courts or not by courts, and there's a level of deference involved? And is there something more than those sort of instinctive judgments that are really driving it in a way that if you were giving advice, you could actually have a good sense as to how the High Court would determine these matters?
I guess my cynical view is it's quite easy to predict. The conferral of power is likely to be upheld whatever body it's given to. That seems to be the lesson I take away from these cases. If a policy decision is given to an administrative body, then that proves its non-judicial power. If it's given to a judicial body, well, it's sufficiently constrained and similar to other conferrals of judicial power. So this is cynical, but I actually think prediction is quite easy. I guess that's all I have to say on that matter.
Another question. I thought, yes,
suppose it's as much a comment as a question. There's a connection between Graham's paper and Ms. Armson's paper, which is that it still does happen, at least it's happened once in a case called Glencore, that decisions of the Takeovers Panel are reviewed under Section 75.5 or 39B. A question that's always interested me, and I don't think the Commonwealth's ever taken this point, is does the delay, enforced delay, in the corporations law, that what some people are identifying as a privative clause, but I think more looks like the flip side of a time limit, not you must bring your case within X days, but you cannot bring your case within X days but may afterwards. If it were ever attempted to be used against 75.5, would run into Bodhidharma problems. Now, the only thing I can't remember is whether the corporations law in terms applies that enforced delay to the High Court. I think at one stage it did, but I have a dim memory that they've amended it since.
I could start. The Corporations Act specifically excludes Section 75 applications, and you're right, the first matter that led to judicial review of the Takeovers Panel since 2000 was the Glencore matter, and that used the constitutional writs. And that was actually referred to by the High Court as one of the reasons why there wasn't a problem in terms of review. The second point that you made in relation to the fact that the delay the fact that it's a time limit, I guess was one of the points that I was raising at the end in terms of possible challenge for the time limitations. And I guess that might be an issue that is raised in the future, although I did note that four of the members of the court looked on these limitations as being only temporary, and as we've pointed out, they don't actually apply to the High Court.
I guess it depends. If you say the test for whether you can have such a law for 75.5 is, does it mean the exercise of jurisdiction is no longer effective? I'm not a corporate person, so I don't know how it works in practice, but I think the answer seems to me probably not, because the court would say... Yeah, well, there you go. That if in that sort of situation, you've at least got...